So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
me. Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
We heard Candice Michelle say that she can beat Melina in any kind of match. Look out! Well, the proof is in the pudding. And so is Melina. With cream in the hair. Oh, baby.
Remember, if you're keeping score at home in this pudding match, it's a pin or submission, King.
Oh, yes.
Update your scoring card.
Oh, you're with the cherry. I feel like we need Bill Cosby out here to help us call this match.
I see pudding people. I wonder if they're at, I was watching WWE 24/7. I saw some Florida Championship wrestling. I thought they didn't have any Florida Championship matches like this game.
Does a pinfall count if it takes place outside the pudding?
I don't know. I wouldn't think not. If it's a pudding match, you need to be in pudding.
Be careful here. Hey!
Chocolate pudding and a spear in the chocolate pudding.
You know, JR, I always practice safe eating. I always use condiments.
Yeah, it's like I'm in a dream. When I wake up, I know that you're still here.
Welcome to Review Away. My name is John Pollock alongside Wei Ting. Wei, how are you?
Pretty good.
That's great.
Pretty good.
Are you excited about this? You and I have never had a one-night stand together.
Oh, we've had
a couple, actually. Yeah, this would be the third one. I think we've reviewed the first two.
Yeah, we have.
So, wow, this is our final.
Third night stand.
Third of four one-night stands in WWE history.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, very exciting stuff. How is everything since Monday night going for you?
Calm.
Calm.
You know, pretty relaxed.
You had the day off on Tuesday. What did you do?
First of all, I went to jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah?
Nice to see you there, finally.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you enjoy that class?
Well, now that you don't do classes with me anymore, it's a little tough.
What are you talking about? We went to the class yesterday.
Yeah, but you did the advanced class.
No, it's the same class. Don't you forget all this already. And then at noon time.
Were we there? Oh, yeah, we went during the day. I keep thinking we went at night.
Yeah.
That's right. So we would be together in the same class.
Yes, yeah. Anyway. So,
it was good.
So how did you enjoy it?
I'm getting back into it. Testing is coming
tough,
up this
tough,
weekend.
Tough coming back into anything after like a prolonged absence.
Listen, I dove in headfirst last week because I went with our pal John Ramdean.
Mm-hmm.
My God, have you ever rolled with this guy?
I have.
He's really good.
He is.
And
yeah, he's been doing it for a long time.
You know, there's sometimes when you'll roll with people and, you know, you're just giving them everything. It's more, you know, it's almost a confidence booster, but at the same time, it can be detrimental because then you start rolling. And it's like, none of this works. John Ramdean doesn't give you anything. You have to work for everything during every drill.
Right.
And he's a larger individual than myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just dead by the end of this class. But it was good.
It was good.
I enjoyed it.
Cool. Awesome. What are some of the obstacles that you had to... Like, why did you take such a long break, first of all?
Well, April was just a horrific month. I left. We had the WrestleMania trip. Then I came back. And then it was instantly off to Montreal for the first of two trips that month.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back, and then we spent an entire week in Montreal, or at least I was there for an entire week. And then I came back, and I was completely out of my rhythm.
Yeah.
And I've just – there are so few nights now I have that when I come home, I do like to spend time with my wife. So I've just been – I totally fell out of the groove of going.
Yeah, it definitely takes you know, it takes being in the same place.
When my schedule's off for jiu-jitsu, it's off.
Yeah.
Off. It's very hard.
I get that. I was like that, too, for the past.
But you're a positive reinforcement to get me to go back, because I know I need to go.
Well, I mean, I've been coming off a bit of a layoff, too. I hurt my ankle, and same with you. I've been doing a lot of traveling, too. But coming back, I think, you know, you get a little out of shape, but I think my whole focus is not even just to, you know, not even to win. It's a little discouraging, like, when all the people that you've been training with are all of a sudden so much better than you because, you know, they've been training while you haven't. But I think my goal is to just simply get a workout in, like, just to sweat. You know, if I'll tap, like, every single round. But as long as, like, you know, as long as I'm there, you know, I'm gaining something.
Did you watch any of the UFC card over the weekend? There was some great submissions.
I just watched the main event. I mean, but I was out on Saturday, but I followed everybody's tweets going on about how great the show was.
It was a very good show. You could watch that main card in 30 minutes.
I think somebody should do that. Just make like a highlight, you know, end-to-end. You know like what they do for hockey games?
Yeah.
Like in an hour or something? What do they call that?
Yeah, game in an hour, something like that.
Or baseball in an hour. They should do that for MMA, for pay-per-views.
They used to do those at the radio station I used to work at where they, like the audio of a game and they'd cut it down into a show.
Oh.
It's like, Jesus Christ, people just listen to anything, I guess.
More so than, you know, the average person talking about it. Sure.
I guess so. They should. They should do that on Fight
they
Pass.
They should, like, especially for wrestling, they should definitely do that. Like, if you, so they do that.
Could you imagine 10-minute Raw?
Yeah.
On the network
actually,
the next
somebody,
day?
Somebody started doing that online, wasn't, like, no, like you started doing that. You did a
no,
TNA.
No. I did it once on Impact where I edited the 2-hour show into 2 minutes, and I think it was perfect.
It was great. It was awesome. Somebody should do that every single week. But not only that, TV stations should just start broadcasting wrestling, like, in 2x speed. You know what I mean? Like, just fast-forwarding the show. You can get through the show. Sometimes, like, I watch these shows. If I have the pause... Because YouTube now, you can actually watch it in, like, 2x speed or...
Oh, YouTube has that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. If they're, like, newer uploads. And you can watch it something, like, twice as fast. Of course, it's not the same. You know, you don't necessarily get the pacing as much. But, like, if you just want to get the gist of a show, you can do that.
I read somewhere in our message board someone listened to our show at 2x the speed. Yeah. And you sounded like... normal talking. And me, I was just all sped up and stuff, so it'd be very confusing, but still fun.
I wonder if there's anybody who listens to us in half speed.
Just to, oh boy,
to draw it out, you know. I got 4 hours to kill.
Imagine that, if you could like isolate audio and then change the speeds of each individual if there is a contrast in their speed.
We're probably heading there.
Yeah, that doesn't even seem that impressive to me. If someone was to come up with that tomorrow, I'd be of course.
It'd be really useless. That's why it probably hasn't been created yet.
It takes so much now to impress me when it comes to technology. Like, everything's done.
Are you going to get an Apple Watch?
No, I'm not.
Have you ever even seen one?
I've only seen the ads. I haven't seen one.
Seen one person wearing one. And I don't know. I've yet to understand the appeal.
Do you know any of the functions?
It could gauge your heart rate, and you could send your heart rate to people.
Wow. Great. Another stupid thing I'll see everyone post on Facebook. Check out my heart rate. God, like, who in the right mind would think anyone outside of your immediate family would want to know your heart rate?
Well, if somebody...
I don't care about the amount of steps you've walked if you want to post that. Like, that's great personal knowledge. Why you would want to share that with the world? And while I'm at it, what you're eating. I don't care. Ever. Ever, 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 ever what you're eating. Never. Never will I ever be thinking, man, what did Way have for dinner last night? I hope he posted it.
I would kind of care. If you had something spectacular that I might want to try someday, let's say, oh, you went to a great rib joint. I'd love to know.
But I'm not posting it for everyone to see what I'm eating. The amount, as we proliferate all this information, the ego of people, just without even trying, it's expanding at such a rapid pace because you have to identify with the fact that, well, everyone must want to know this about me. Like, that has to be a given.
I mean, not necessarily everybody, but I think some people care. And I definitely struggle with this, you know, posting anything online. I feel like...
Because of people like me that criticize or just in general?
No, because, I mean, I would do the same criticism.
You're one of the funnier posters I know.
No, I'm not.
Because I know your humor, and I always think you're very
funny. What do I even post?
You always post something that I won't even say snarky. It's not snarky. It's just you always say something. It's just a great punchline. Like, you were designed for like short 140 character bursts.
Interesting.
Okay. Honestly, there's a lot of people that would flood out of Twitter. You would not be one of them.
Okay, you wouldn't block me or you wouldn't mute me.
I wouldn't mute you.
Okay, that's good.
I would follow you. No matter what.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I feel self-conscious every time I post anything up there, you know, just thinking, am I adding anything? I think at some level you just have to, like, not give a shit and just post whatever you feel, you know?
I want to see. Way's a big retweeter as well. Like, if you say
anything... Well, why do I need to say it?
He'll retweet it.
It's already been said. Why do I need to say it?
I really got to dig here.
Yeah, I don't...
You guys are going to have to dig very deep into my online history to find the proper spelling of my full name. Was this not the best contest we've ever run?
It really was the best contest.
And tell people where your name was logged.
Well, for
the
people
archives.
People who don't follow the TV version of Review Raw, every week we do a contest, a T-shirt giveaway from Pro Wrestling Tees, where at some point during the show, a strange man walks behind us, behind our set in the middle of the show, with a skill testing question. And every single week it's something wrestling related, and I guess this week John decided to come up with a question that was more show related.
Last week,
yes. And he asked people to spell Way's full name
with like three underlining lines.
Yeah, full.
Full.
That's right. And so, you know, immediately I was like, no one's going to get this. How are people even going to find this? I haven't really gone by my full name in a long, long time. And so the responses just started to flood in.
Because they've all heard it.
They all know my
name is
Wei Chung. Wei Chung. But, like, nobody knew how to spell it. It's a very distinct spelling that I was like, when they gave it to me, I was like, are you sure? Are you sure this is how I should spell it?
I had people, because after like a day of just ridiculous interpretations of how you spell this
name.
Not
that ridiculous. I mean,
creative, but incorrect.
I would have probably, it's been, you know, wrong my whole life.
But so. I simply wrote that the contest is still wide open. No one's gotten it yet. And I had people argue with me. Like as if
I think some people just
I'm lying.
Some people just misinterpreted. They probably didn't get the fact that you had to actually properly spell it, which was a tough task.
Well, of course you've got to spell it properly.
And so I looked it up, and you know, there were only a couple places online where the full spelling existed, and one of them, one person actually did find, was on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/way0937, which I just rarely use, but on one of our older videos, actually. One of the first projects we did together for the Fight Network was a series of interstitials about Ring of Honor talent. And one of them was about Samoa Joe. And so if you just even Google Fight Short Samoa Joe, you'll see at the bottom it says produced by John Pollock and Wei Chung Ting.
There was one smoking gun.
But a couple of other people found it via my Facebook, which I didn't even realize it was up there.
Wow. Those are the kind of trivia questions we got to strive for. Ones that require work and
sure.
Not just some quick Google search.
I like that.
I think anyone who got that, I mean, you're really rewarded.
Yeah. Oh, what a reward.
You get a T-shirt.
Oh, yes. And you know my
And you know
full
Way's
identity.
Full name.
Yeah.
I was really hoping you wouldn't see the question before we posted it, so the next day you'd just suddenly get all these people guessing your name and then, what the hell was the question?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got a good question this week. We'll see how people do.
I like the question this week.
Yeah. It was your own idea this week.
YouTube.com/Fight Network. Yeah. Just click on the show. Look for the question. Just give us some hits.
Yeah. You just have to watch the video.
Make a funny comment. Put a funny comment on the comment section. Hateful. Not hateful.
You don't care.
We appreciate it.
Whatever. Just respond.
Yeah.
Well, are you ready for One Night Stand?
Yes.
Tonight, the only rules are extreme rules.
Balls count anywhere, match.
Stretcher match.
Steel cage match.
Lumberjack match.
Tables match.
Ring fight.
How extreme will it be?
What a show. Why did we pick this last week? It was just, it was a,
it's a
someone...
June show, and it was in the request thread.
Who requested this?
I have no idea.
I had many people ask, why are you reviewing this? This just feels like such an innocuous show, but it was... I think there's always stuff to find in any show you go back to.
Definitely.
And this was certainly a you know, a month that I won't say is remembered for the right reasons, but this was, of course, the month of everything that went down with Chris Benoit at the end of June. So kind of creepy to go back here and see Chris Benoit's final appearance on a WWE pay-per-view in kind of just a cameo role on the show.
Yeah, it. I mean, it's funny because I think when, you know, some type of tragedy surrounds any situation, you can look back and like find so much that wasn't there before, and whether or not it's, you know, if it's just our brains trying to connect all this stuff when there really is no connection, it could be that.
Well, I mean, only professional wrestling can create such a scenario where, as this horrific story was about to go down in June, that the WWE, their main storyline was building up to the death of a key figure, and then the day that everything happened with Benoit, they had a whole funeral setup for Raw that night for Vince McMahon's funeral. Like, only in professional wrestling could something
so weird.
Fucked
yeah.
happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just the most bizarre story and industry mm-hmm. as a whole. So with that, let's get into some wrestling action. I certainly watched this show at the time. My God, this was the closest you're going to have to, like, a Vince Russo show. There were stipulation matches from top to bottom on this thing, including a first on pay-per-view, a pudding match.
Yeah. That's extreme.
Yeah.
The subtitle of the show, though, was also Extreme Rules. Was this the first Extreme Rules show?
This was the first, yeah. This was the first one-night stand that did not have the ECW throwback show after mm-hmm. those great shows in 2005 and 6. ECW had been reintroduced, and certainly this was a much different ECW, and they were not going to present that kind of a show this year, and instead we got just another WWE pay-per-view.
But with the Extreme Rules banner attached to it, so that, you know, they took pretty much the least important part of ECW
yeah.
and decided to expand on
it. It was the
that.
Gimmicks.
Yeah.
That's what everyone just pined for.
The pudding matches.
The great days of pudding matches yeah. and lumberjack matches.
That's why they're successful.
And what a hit this was. 186,000 buys on pay-per-view wow. worldwide. A tremendous success. This would be 2 weeks after the Judgment Day pay-per-view and 2 weeks before the Vengeance pay-per-view.
Oh, just like this week.
Yeah.
This so, current string of pay-per-views.
Just pay-per-views galore at this particular time.
Did you watch this on the network?
I did.
I did too. And
we weren't privy to a Puddle of Mud's contribution.
Immediately, you just notice all the musical editing, because like the theme song that they played on the network version was just the most generic rock theme. And I mean, I have to like... Knowing how difficult you know, it can be to edit music to a specific song... I can only imagine the job that these editors had to take out that Puddle of Mud song and replace it with a completely, you know, different track, but still have the edits somewhat match the beat of the songs. And but you know, watching this version, you immediately knew something was off.
Yeah, it was, to me, it was like, it didn't feel as though it was smacking you over the head that it was edited. It just felt so generic, this
yeah.
music, and everyone attached to this music just felt like nothing.
Yeah.
Like, this is like an indie. It was as minor league as the WWE can feel, which mm-hmm. is a stretch. So it opened up with a video listing off every single stipulation match except for the pudding match. They omitted it from their big hit you over the head that this is Extreme Rules and pudding. And just rattling off everything and stating that the Great Khali could be the next WWE champion, which was equally concerning. And this took place one night after Saturday night's main event, where the Great Khali pinned John Cena clean going into this. And you know that what was notable about that Saturday night's main event?
No.
You and I were at it.
What?
It was filmed in Toronto.
Oh.
The prior Monday.
I don't recall.
In Toronto at the Air Canada
Center. Are you sure I was there?
You and I went, and we were in the nice box, the private box, and we got food.
I have no recollection.
I'm 1,000% sure you were with me.
Like in the ACC?
We were at the ACC.
We watched that match?
Yes, they taped this before Raw.
I have no recollection.
It was a Raw or a SmackDown. I can't remember. But we went because I distinctly remember you getting a drink and some food and pulling out your wallet. And the guy was like, no, 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 it's all free. And you were stunned, as was I.
I do not remember that. You have a great memory.
Well,
I have a terrible memory.
I remember food.
No,
food and wrestling.
Because I probably tweeted about it. I probably took a photo.
I don't know. This is probably pre-Twitter.
You might have MySpace.
I probably took a photo
and you cared so much about my food photo that you remember.
Yeah, exactly. So the announcers for this particular show, we had three sets of them for One Night Stand. We had Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler on Raw, Michael Cole and JBL on SmackDown, and Joey Styles and Taz on the ECW desk previewing all of their main events. And we had an entranceway with all the bricks and weapons plastered over it.
These sets certainly, you know, looked very, very much, much larger than I'll say they do in the network era. You know what I mean? Like, they really went all out.
Yeah, they had quite the production budget at this particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of chairs that they could glue onto these bricks.
They had a crane.
Yeah, they had... Nothing that you would really equate with, like, oh, it's extreme. Look, there's construction equipment.
Yeah.
Let's get a tank.
It's dangerous.
It's a
dangerous area. You need, like, to walk around a crane without a hard hat can be considered extreme.
Right across from a pool of pudding. The most extreme. Like, what a...
You could get diabetes if you ate all that.
I guess, yeah.
It's pretty extreme.
Yeah. We started things off, the only way you start off a One Night Stand Extreme Rules event, with a stretcher match. Randy Orton against Rob Van Dam.
Rob Van Dam, the man who main evented the show last year and left with the championship.
What a fall from grace here opening up this year's show. And this would be his final night with the WWE before his contract was up. So, booking 101. We had Orton punting Shawn Michaels in the lead up to this, which sent Shawn Michaels off because he was dealing with a knee injury at the time. And this made Rob Van Dam very angry during a WWE.com interview, and thus we have a match. And the storyline going into this was that Randy Orton had injured Rob Van Dam, and Van Dam was dealing with concussion problems.
Mm-hmm.
So his head was at less than optimal utilization.
It was Rob Van Dam basically working a concussion, you know, angle heading into this match. And what does it say, though, about, you know, him even being allowed to wrestle the match? No concern really brought up.
Their world was about to drastically change over the next couple of months. And concussion storylines would be...
treated with a bit more realism, also.
Yeah. And now this was pre-partnership with Chris Nowinski.
Mm.
So Lawler predicts that the loser will be, quote, finished. He could not be more wrong. Van Dam blasts Orton in the face with a kick at the very start, and Lawler refers to him as Rob Van Bam with this kick to the face.
Oh, my God. At what point did he just give up, Lawler? Like, he used to be so witty. He used to, like, have such good lines.
You know, I think the turning point was when he came back in 2001, and he was at that point, he was very much just...
I'm surprised we didn't see highlights like this in the documentary.
No, this stuff never made it in there.
Rob Van Bam.
That should have been an Easter egg. Like, Jerry Lawler's worst/best jokes that he just would whip out. Like, they're horrendous now. But it's like... There was that time period when he came back after the heart attack where it's like, God, the overselling of the announcers laughing at these horrible jokes. It's like, okay, no one can say anything bad about Lawler, but enough time has passed now that you can look at him like the jokes that he'll bring out are just, they're so amateur hour.
Yeah.
But we digress. Van Dam blocks an RKO with a kick, hops up for the 5-star frog splash, but loses his balance and tumbles to the floor because his head is a mess. But none of the medical staff can step in here at this man who is going to kill himself. And Orton takes advantage, stomps the head in the ring, and finally rolls him over to the stretcher, but Van Dam fights back. Then Orton is on the stretcher, and Van Dam hits a twisting leg drop off the apron to Orton, brings Orton back to the ring, and Orton counters a rolling thunder with a quick power slam, which was a nice transition. Van Dam then drop kicks Orton, sending him to the floor, puts him on the stretcher, and Van Dam then misses with a somersault plancha over the top and lands on the stretcher.
Ugh.
If he was working a concussion angle, this might have been God's way of saying, hey, I'll help you out with the selling portion.
I really have no idea what these two were thinking, you know, even attempting something like that. If you didn't see the match, essentially it's a spot that I think we've seen a lot of times where, you know, a guy puts a table on the outside, somebody else jumps over the top rope, in this case Rob Van Dam, with a somersault plancha, supposedly going through the table. But the problem is, this table happened to have wheels on it.
Oh.
You know what I mean? And it just didn't work. Somehow this thing rolled away. Like, Orton was supposed to get off, so Orton got off. I suppose he thought that this table would stay in place, but of course when he got off, the table, the stretcher rolled along with him, and so Van Dam basically just landed, oh man, spectacularly, on the floor. It looked fine. I suppose it added to the realism of the match and the injury thing he was doing, but man, did it look...
Well, other than the guy taking painful. The worst end of the most horrific bump in this match was just minutes away from winning this whole match.
Yeah.
Because Van Dam is then wheeled up on the stretcher, but then right before he passes the imaginary mark of death... that's just painted there. Van Dam kicks him in the head, puts Orton on the stretcher near the line, and shoves him over at 14:35, and Jim Ross yells, "I cannot believe it!"
It was a very somewhat anticlimactic finish, and a confusing finish, especially considering that this was Van Dam's last match. And also...
And Orton was scheduled to be your title challenger all summer long, including 3 weeks after this show on the next pay-per-view in a multiple-person match.
What do you think was the idea of putting Van Dam over?
This was, at the time, it was flat-out said that Vince thought everyone knew Van Dam was leaving, so let's surprise them. Like, a token, like, in-a-bubble kind of thinking.
Yeah.
It's just so stupid. And then it was just everything about the post-match was Orton getting his heat back to try and take your focus off of the winner of the match. He just destroyed Van Dam, punts him in the head from the apron with a, quote, brain-rattling kick, according to Ross. And then Van Dam is out on the floor. His eyes are open and glazed. And then it hits a draping DDT onto the floor from the barricade. And eventually the EMTs come out to check on him, and Orton just poses in the aisleway. I will say, for Rob Van Dam, some of his best selling, like the eyes, just completely, just that concussed look on his face, that made it, told the story very effectively. But this was just such a stupid finish where you are paying attention to the wrong subsection of fans and not telling the proper story in order to just swerve people for the sake of swerving it. There's nothing I hate more.
I thought it was an entertaining match overall, and, you know, Van Dam... Certainly, if you're going to do a head injury thing, there's no better guy to take head bumps than, you know, Rob Van Dam. He certainly made a lot of those DDTs look tremendous. I'll say I thought they went a little overboard with the whole concussion thing, especially, you know, knowing how with concussions and just the general increase of knowledge about concussions in general, there's no way the amount of head trauma this man suffered in this match, you know, would it just took me out of it how overboard they went with some of the damage that this guy took. But I guess this was a different time, and it was an overall entertaining match.
Yeah, and I mean, the WWE's relationship with education on concussions has been fascinating if you've followed it throughout this time period all the way up to the present, because it was after everything with Chris Benoit and diagnosing his brain and Chris Nowinski becoming front and center at that time as one of the leading experts on concussion awareness. And the WWE, they completely dismissed Chris Nowinski as having anything credible to attach to the argument. And now they are completely on board with Chris Nowinski. And Triple H is even on the board of directors with Chris Nowinski's group. So it's evolved quite a lot over the last number of years. And I won't say it's perfect, but you've seen many cases where guys have gotten concussions. They have not been cleared, even if they Randy Orton, I know that they shelved for a while. Christian, we have still not seen come back. And I guess most assume he's retired at this point, but it was right before WrestleMania last year that he suffered a concussion. And it was right before we interviewed him at Access. And he was like, I don't know if I'm going to be on this show. And that was over a year ago. So, I mean, they do take concussions, I think, significantly more seriously than even 5 years ago, where a lot of the times it was just, you know, just grit your teeth and go work with it.
We also really haven't seen, you know, a ton of concussions in storyline, even. Or if we do, they're treated with a lot more realism, you know? Like, I don't think they're hesitant to just stop a match whenever a guy is seemingly concussed.
Yeah, and I think as well the overall just acceptance of concussions is so much more, even amongst athletes who, I mean, there was not all that long ago the idea of you sitting out with a concussion. You were absolutely peer pressured to just go on with a head injury. And that's not just wrestling. That's any sport. You hear stories about that. So I think overall people have made giant leaps just in terms of concussions and treating them significantly. Next up, a tag team tables match involving what a six person conglomerate this was.
We had a segment with Shane and Vince back.
Oh, that's too. Right. We had Vince and Shane. Vince McMahon was the ECW champion at this point in history, saying tonight he will end Bobby Lashley. And then Vince says he has a premonition that something really bad is going to happen to me, like a slow eating cancer. And Dr. Shane diagnosed this as probably something he ate. Nothing to worry about and to not think about it. And this was, of course, telegraphing what would be the big angle a week later during a three-hour Raw where they would infamously blow up Vince McMahon's limousine. And Vince McMahon had the sixth sense to know that a doomsday was coming for his character.
Mm.
Little did he know he would be brought back to life 3 weeks after that. The Sandman, Tommy Dreamer, and CM Punk. What a dream team. Against Elijah Burke, Matt Stryker, and Marcus Corvon, the former Monty Brown, featuring we had the play-by-play announcer for Lucha Underground and the color commentator for Impact on one side of this, against the UFC fighter, the House of Hardcore promoter, and the Sandman, who Joey Styles called the most unlikely athlete ever.
Sure.
I don't think this man ever fully earned the term athlete, ever.
Mm.
Maybe one of the most untalented wrestlers that ever got to any level of popularity, significant level of popularity.
But, you know, I'll say, though, he definitely does that walkout way more effectively than Roman Reigns. To the crowd.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Of course, this was non-Metallica entrance.
On the network, yes.
Well, at the time as well. He wasn't coming out to Metallica during this time. No.
Oh my God, this looked awful.
I don't think this was dubbed over on the network.
The whole time I was picturing like Enter Sandman over top of this. But no,
they never splurged for Enter Sandman. Taz wishes the best for Rob Van Dam and says that last match was hard to watch for him. But we've got to move on. So what does Elijah Burke do? He targets the skull of Tommy Dreamer. So the agents here, a one-track mind. CM Punk came in, hit a running bulldog onto the head of Stryker, and then bounces over. Dreamer and Punk did the Team 3D get the table spot while Team 3D was long gone and members of TNA at this point involved in fish market street fights at this point. And Punk then hit a suicide dive to Marcus Corvon. Is there a maneuver that has been killed more than the suicide dive? Pardon the pun. There was a suicide dive
Maybe the German suplex.
Yeah, there was a suicide dive I saw on television last week. I think it was on SmackDown. I have never heard such a non-reaction to one. Like nothing. It was like the reaction you'd hear for a headlock takeover.
Mm.
It has been done to death. I'm not even trying. It's all I can say here about the suicide dive. But it's just, God, there needs to be a moratorium on this move.
I mean, I still think it's pretty impressive, and I still think it gets a big cheer. But sure, you're right. When people, everybody could do it, it's not that impressive anymore.
They're all fighting on the floor. There was a table that was brought out where the leg was broken, so they had to get a new table. Burke then drops a big elbow out of the corner to Punk's ribs, and then they set up the table in the corner. Dreamer makes a save for Punk, and then Sandman climbs to the top and gets shoved to the floor by Matt Stryker. And you weren't going to see the Sandman again, I thought. Corvon then powerbombs Punk. We got a 2-on-2 number. Should I answer it?
Sure.
From New York.
Phone call in the middle of the show.
Hello?
Hey, Ken.
No, this is John.
Nope. Oh, this is John?
Yes.
Oh, is Ken there?
There is no Ken here.
Ken who?
Gonzalez?
No, I think you have the wrong number.
What station are you guys?
We are with TSN Radio.
Okay. Okay. I will try giving him a call on another number then. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Okay.
I was really hoping that was... I've been getting this 1-800 number, like, every other day for the past month, and I'm ready for the next time I get it, and we're recording.
Have you been picking up?
No, I haven't. I've been ignoring it, because I'm saving it for something that would be fun to hear on one of our shows, so I'm hoping.
Who's Ken Gonzalez?
I have no idea who Ken Gonzalez is, but I know who that was calling.
Who was that?
That was to set up a UFC interview, actually.
Oh. Okay, you'll probably edit this out.
50-50. We'll see. We get back to the match here. The Sandman took a dive to the floor. Then what happened? Dreamer hit a pile driver to Elijah Burke. Burke's put on the table. Punk superplexes Matt Stryker off the top, putting Burke through the table, and they win at 7 minutes and 19 seconds. And then these three goofballs posed with the most silly-looking pose. The Sandman, Tommy Dreamer, and CM Punk, who, God, this was the geekiest CM Punk during his WWE tenure.
Definitely. This was like, you know...
Babyface cheer for me, CM Punk.
Yeah, kind of corny, and definitely knowing his, you know, getting a better sense of his personality these days, this definitely seemed like very fake. You know, like it seemed like something that wasn't really genuine to his personality. He just kind of played generic good guy. But I'll say, you know, I thought the match was actually quite sloppy. You know, a bunch of guys who really aren't the most graceful or technical here, and it seemed to just lack structure, like you'd see, you know, in some of the better constructed hardcore matches out there. But I think it got over simply because of the strength of the baby faces here in Sandman, Dreamer, and Punk. You know, even though he was more vanilla than what he eventually became, he still looked the best out of the six here.
The Sandman staggered to the back. He looked like a walker going to the back. This man, both from a looks perspective and his movements.
That's the other character, isn't it? Didn't they have a zombie on the show?
Well, Sandman easily could have picked up where the ECW zombie left off. And Stryker is grabbing his knee at the end. Edge is in the locker room backstage. He is the world champion at this point. Orton walks in, the former Rated RKO members, and mentions that his two former partners are having a cage match tonight in reference to Edge and Batista, saying it doesn't matter because in 1 month he has taken out Rob Van Dam and Shawn Michaels, and warns Edge that if he gets drafted to SmackDown, then he'll be next. And Edge says that Orton is going to end up just like Batista will tonight, teasing something that would never come to fruition prior to the draft.
Oh, yeah, right. And the draft is coming up. I mean, was this not even at the time where they still like to, you know, do these little interbrand teasers?
Yeah, they would do these on the pay-per-views, but it was becoming less and less special because there was a lot of guys appearing on multiple shows with the ECW guys, and you know, Lashley was technically an ECW guy who was being used on Raw most weeks. It was, the brands were certainly starting to have less and less specialness to it, I guess, for lack of a better term. Ross gives us an update on Rob Van Dam. He has sustained yet another concussion.
Mm-hmm.
Great job, medical staff. And we had a rare fan standing behind them who was a Putski nominee. This dude had to have been a worker. Had to have been.
Wow.
No sleeves, guns out.
Is he the official candidate here?
I'm going to put this fan That's okay. One of the candidates.
Cool.
Did you see the WWE put out a list of their top 10 fans last week on WWE.com?
I did see that.
Number one.
Vladimir. Was that a ranking or was it just a list?
I don't know what the difference is.
Well, I mean, a ranking suggests that number one is better than the rest.
I see what you mean. Well, I guess it's a subjective list.
Okay.
Sure. Vladimir is, I mean, when you think WWE fans, mm-hmm. I mean, they pretty much hit the nail on the head for just about any time you say wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Those are kind of the ones you think of.
It was a pretty good list. They got all of them. They got Sign Guy. They got Miz Girl. They got Brock Lesnar Guy.
They've got the best team at WWE.com for yeah. those kind of stories. It's like it's wrestling geeks, mm-hmm. which is perfect.
Mm-hmm. And they have all the access that you know you could want, and they've managed to use it well.
Then we had the Hardys against the world's greatest tag team in a ladder match for the world tag titles. Jeff walks under all of the ladders on his way to the ring. There are some people that don't believe in multiple years of bad luck following this, but Jeff Hardy really did test his luck in 2007. He had a rough stretch after this. And they sandwich Haas between the ladders in the corners as we get things underway, and then Benjamin gets placed against the outer ladder to hit the Poetry in Motion. This was also the time that it was the most painful nickname I can see being just labeled on top of a guy, where Jim Ross had to identify Jeff Hardy as the Rainbow Warrior. That's the Rainbow Warrior. It was so awkward. And I think I interviewed Jeff Hardy around this time, and I even asked him, like, what is up with this nickname? And I think he agreed it sucked.
We're gonna call him the Rainbow Warrior.
Like, just picture a fresh rainbow from the rain forming above your grass, and out emerges a warrior with the physique of Jeff Hardy.
Through the power of rainbows, he engages in war.
Well, like, what contrasting images? A warrior and a rainbow. What would happen if they came together? Jeff Hardy would happen.
He'd fight you with love.
We've got the Rainbow Warrior and Matt. Matt got nothing here. This was actually, for Jeff Hardy, this was actually the time when he was starting to really grow as a singles performer. He had, of course, the tag team with Matt, but this was when the Umaga feud was about to kick off. They would have the Randy Orton program the following year, and unfortunately had a few wellness violations at this point, including later on that year. But this was when Jeff Hardy was starting to pick up a lot of momentum, at least as a singles performer, and would really branch out from just simply being a tag wrestler. And that's why I thought this kind of a match, is this a ladder match that you've ever thought of over the last 8 years?
No.
Like, these guys killed each other in this match. And it was just, to me, it was like, well, we have nothing for the Hardys. Let's put them in a ladder match mm-hmm. on this pretty much nothing pay-per-view. And they went out. Everyone worked hard in this match. And we had this teeter-totter spot where the Hardys send Benjamin onto the ladder and then sent him across with this beel, which sent the top of the ladder onto Haas. Then they balanced this larger ladder between the ring and the barricade. They suplexed Haas onto it, sternum first, and then Benjamin runs at Matt and takes a back body drop over the top onto the ladder that is leveled here. And Matt then places Benjamin onto that ladder. Jeff goes to the top. Haas stops him, and there is a rotating belly to back off the top to Jeff. Matt's then placed on the ladder on the floor, and Haas is holding it up. Benjamin springboards over another ladder into this backbreaker on top of Matt, coming up with as creative spots as you can for a ladder match. But I think largely by 2007, you had seen so many of these matches that it was hard to really break out from the pack when it comes to significant ladder spots that are memorable. I mean, they had just been so exhausted at this point. And then we had Jeff climbing. Shelton goes for a springboard, and he falls over mid-move, and rotated himself and just caught the ladder with his foot upon landing and managed to knock the ladder over. And I thought Jim Ross did a great job of just trying to sell this as this great feat of, you know, talent that Absolutely. Shelton Benjamin was able to pull off. And they even replayed it. And, I mean, yeah, it was a fuck-up, but it worked. He was able to do what he intended to, and the announcers saved the guy instead of letting him hang out there to dry.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's very lucky that he managed to get enough momentum to actually get the ladder to tip over.
Pretty impressive in midair to be able to rotate yourself and still, I don't know how he caught the ladder and with such little connection, still knocked this ladder over. So they did salvage it.
They did. But I'll say, you know, this certainly was, for all the Money in the Bank performances that I think we know Shelton for, he seemed to mess up a number of times in this match, and this was one of those spots, but he happened to save this one.
And then at the end, all four are climbing. The Hardys get tipped over, and then they tip the ladder over with Haas and Benjamin on the ladder, and Benjamin goes to the floor. Jeff hits a swanton to Haas as Matt climbs the ladder, grabs the titles at 17 minutes, 18 seconds, and they cut to this fanatical girl just screaming in the crowd. And the Hardys retain the tag team titles, and Haas and Benjamin are pondering a new tag name.
On paper, I think this match looked like it would be awesome. You know, Hardy's, with their signature match, you could say. And I think any time in the match where the Hardys were in control, there were definitely moments where, you know, this was one of those you could see being a very good match, much on the level of, you know, their classics. It's noticeable, especially watching the match previous to this, to just that generic hardcore match. What I think separates a lot of the Hardys, you know, Team 3D, Edge and Christian matches from a typical hardcore match is the creativity of these spots and the structure that they, you know, go into these gimmick matches with, planning all these things. And just their lack of hesitation and the precision with which they execute a lot of these spots. They always seem to know where to go, and their timing is very good. But when Haas and Benjamin were in control here, I thought the match definitely seemed to lose a bit of focus. Haas in particular seemed very lost and kind of much more uncomfortable in there with the gimmicks than the rest. And even Shelton, you know, like I said earlier, who's kind of known for being, you know, very, very comfortable with a ladder. He seemed to have a number of fuck-ups here. But it was still entertaining. The guys worked very hard, like you said. A lot of painful-looking bumps that all these guys took. But it didn't really necessarily meet my expectations.
And I know it's hard when you're watching a show that's 8 years old to kind of label it as such. But I felt a lot of the gimmick matches on this show, it just felt really outdated in terms of just these hardcore matches. And I don't think it's a stretch to say in 2007, people had seen their fill of a lot of these matches. And I know I say that with a pay-per-view coming up on Sunday night where we have two ladder matches on a WWE event.
I think one focused gimmick is fine, you know, like a Money in the Bank or an Elimination Chamber. To put the emphasis on one big stipulation is cool, but I mean,
this was just stipulations filling them out on a card.
You're just watering everything down at that point. You know, I don't have one concept to attach to get excited for. The more you do, the less meaningful it all becomes.
Ranjan Singh was with the Great Khali backstage, and Singh would speak in English, and then Great Khali would just yell. It might have been in Hindi. It could have been any language. I don't know what this individual was saying. And they focused on him pinning Cena the night before, not just pinning him with one foot on the chest of John Cena. Mm-hmm. I don't think Kevin Owens will be doing that this Sunday.
Probably not.
So he is going to go back to India and celebrate his title win.
How was the Great Khali? How long had he debuted?
He had already been in there a year.
Okay. And how would you say that year went?
In terms of, you know, he was introduced as a monster, and his first pay-per-view, clean pin on The Undertaker, which I thought was super effective. But the Great Khali I mean, it's no surprise. This guy was an extremely limited performer. And I was never against the idea that you can't have these big monsters to have different characters, but you need to know that the shelf life is what it is. And the Great Khali, by a year after this, he was largely in the comedy role, which was about the fact you got a year out of him and a handful of main events and even putting the world title on him later this summer. It's more than I thought they would get out of this guy. So afterwards, we introduced the Lumberjacks to the ultra generic production theme for this next match.
And I'm assuming that they came out to the Puddle of Mud song instead of this.
Which was interesting because the song was called Famous, and I would say the majority of these Lumberjacks, anything but.
First man out?
Chris Benoit was our first Lumberjack out there.
As a Lumberjack.
This guy didn't fit into this at all. Like, these were, like, the cast-offs of the WWE main roster. And Chris Benoit was not a cast-off by this time in 2007. He was coming out of that feud with MVP, but still very much solid part of the mid-card. But here he was grouped with the likes of Balls Mahoney, Stevie Richards, Val Venus, who, I mean, he was looking at that. This was his WrestleMania main event. I was going to steal the show with my reactions. Val Venus. Santino Marella, who had just won the IC title upon introduction, and babyface Santino.
Who was not playing a comedy.
This dude character was dying a death at this point. The Miz, Kevin Thorne, Chris Masters, Johnny Nitro, Chavo Guerrero, Ken Dykstra, and Carlito.
To see these guys walk out one by one to this generic song on the network version, it just played like this weird fan-created YouTube highlight montage of, like, 2007 mid-carders.
Holy Christ.
It was weird. And because they dubbed over the music, you didn't get any commentary over top, so it was just like it played like a high, like a weird, the strangest highlight video anybody would ever create.
It was like some shitty PlayStation 1 game you were playing where you're just introducing the Lumberjacks.
Like, the worst game ever. Like, they couldn't get licenses for The Undertaker, but they got Kenny Dykstra.
Oh, and that cleared the way. Now, keep in mind, folks, Chris Benoit was penciled in here to be a Lumberjack on this show because we had to leave room for Mark Henry against Kane. I don't care what year it was. There was never an excuse for these two to have a singles match for 9 minutes.
It was hard to believe that this was 8 years ago because both men look very similar today, but really, this match could have happened anywhere between 1996 and 2015.
Didn't this match happen on Raw Monday?
I can't remember. I can't remember either. But, I mean, are there any other – who else on the current roster, on the active roster that's there week to week, has been around longer than these two?
Oh, at this rate? I mean, Kane and – I mean, outside of John Cena, I mean –
There have been people there longer than Cena.
Oh, I thought you were saying from 2007 till.
No, dude,
this point.
I'm talking about Mark Henry and Kane.
These are 20 year characters.
Yeah,
20 years you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're counting the Isaac Yankem years,
sure. Man, yeah, outside of like Triple H, Taker.
There's going to be some Raw where he's going to come out as the dentist 1 week. They'll do it once.
I'd love it. I think he's as close now as he's ever been.
JBL says there are 6 billion people on Earth. Mark Henry is the strongest. Kane gets tossed to the floor, and the Lumberjacks won't touch him, instantly rendering these Lumberjacks useless. Henry goes to the floor, though, and he just tosses everyone away, just reinforcing that point. Henry then drives Kane's back into the apron in the steel post, so we got a backstory for the match. Kane was hitting him with headbutts. Mark Henry was trying to get over the bear hug in 2007, and Way, okay. I'm gonna clear the floor for you at the end of this match for some historical context. Kane then goes for a choke slam, but his back gives out. Henry goes back to the bear hug. JBL starts yelling over the Lumberjacks acting as cheerleaders, and Kane just falls out of the bear hug to the mat, and the crowd, feeling the effects of this bear hug, are all unconscious. Henry goes to the floor. Kane is on top and hits a cross body to Henry and the Lumberjacks, and then a top rope clothesline and a choke slam in the ring, which did get a pop from the crowd. Chavo and Dykstra then run in to attack Kane. He fights them off. He delivers a chokeslam to Dykstra. Henry gets up and applies another bear hug. And out of nowhere, Jimmy Corderas calls for the stoppage. Completely flat finish as Kane is out cold from the bear hug.
They were working really hard to get over Mark Henry's bear hug. And it's appropriate because we're coming off of
the Heyman interview.
The Heyman interview where he proposed that, oh, what if somebody like Mark Henry did a headlock and you really put over the headlock and the headlock will be feared? I think they attempted that with the bear hug here with Mark Henry.
If these were like, if he was just destroying guys with 10 seconds of bear hugs and then Kane lasts 30 seconds and is out, I guarantee you people would have reacted more to that. This was like 4 minutes of this match was a bear hug.
Yeah, this was just really boring. You know,
it this was really, terrible.
These bear hugs, I think bear hugs in general, people are conditioned to just treat as rest holds or others. And, you know, at this point, you're right. If it was just like almost something immediate and the selling was better, I think it is
there's no urgency to move.
You're right. Absolutely. Here, it was very flat. Very flat. So on the topic of bear hugs.
This is the greatest research you have ever contributed.
I was like, just, you know, doing a bit of research after this match, looking about, like, I wondered if Mark Henry actually had a name for his bear hug. So I Googled Mark Henry bear hug. And sure enough, I'd like to know at this point if anybody knows where I'm going to go listening. Because if you do...
I had never heard of this.
I looked up Mark Henry bear hug, and all of a sudden I find like a strange database. I'm like, okay, is this like a database that lists every single wrestling finisher? No. This was a database of only bear hugs. Like, somebody out there has compiled a database of every bear hug that's ever existed, not just in pro wrestling. When it gets really
strange.
Was
it Brad?
It was not Brad.
Oh.
It was a website that compiled every bear hug in existence in every form of media. I'm talking comic books. I'm talking movies. I'm talking commercials.
Were you stunned that bear hugs existed outside of pro wrestling? Because I was.
I mean, at some point, I believe that they just, like, every instance of, like, a long, aggressive hug was probably listed here. But if you want to check it out yourself, bearhugger.net.
Bearhugger.
Bearhugger.net. And let me just even read you the disclaimer off the top in the front page. Warning. The contents of this website may offend some viewers. The bear hug submission hold in wrestling has a straight overtone to many people. It is a symbol of power and can be used as a test of strength. For others, the hold can have a gay overtone for various reasons. You are warned that this visualization of the bear hug hold may be disturbing for some viewers. Please leave if you do not wish to see or know more about it. Otherwise, feel free to enter. So,
wow, what an unnecessary warning.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's so interesting. And I mean, that's cool. I suppose there's a fetish for like everything out there. But I'm amused because this one is somewhat wrestling related. I wonder if the one exists for like, you know, the camel clutch or, what else could you see? But
the
anyway.
Greco-Roman knuckle lock.
Sure. But, yeah, you can see like the newest bear hugs in cartoons, newest bear hugs in video games, newest bear hug stories. So a lot of interesting reading for you all to check out.
What an underappreciated maneuver, submission hold rather.
I think who would you say has the best bear hug?
Had the best bear hug?
Yeah, well, a bear hug that you could actually foreseeably see as being a good viable finisher.
I mean, I never really bought it as a finish, and I think that's there's no submission you can't get over if you decide you're going to get it over. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always go back to the example of The Undertaker's Gogo Plata, which no one knew how to react to. When he introduced it, there would be crickets at times, and that ended up closing WrestleMania in 2008, where all of a sudden, every guy tapped to it. It's like, this must be a legitimate hold. If you're not a mixed martial arts fan, it looks so goofy. And combine that with the Undertaker's application of the hold, It's like, what am I watching?
Yeah.
But a guy's tapping, and that tells me, oh, it's working. And you buy the finish. And I think that's why, you know, the, for so long, I mean, how effective way is an arm bar? You have destroyed ligaments in my arm applying arm bars.
I've had ligaments destroyed.
But how many times do you go back and you'll watch a wrestling match where it's like, guy has a fully extended arm bar applied, and it's just a transition.
Yeah, the armbar, I mean, it's taken a lot more seriously these days, but back
then, you almost have to. It's like wrestling was forced to evolve what an armbar means because everyone understands it as a legitimate finishing hold.
You're totally right, but I think on some level, it has to look good. You know, the person doing it has to make it look effective. And so, you know, we're thinking about who has, like, the best-looking bear hug. I thought, like, Brock, when he did it at a time, I remember that match with Hogan.
Right.
There's a big bear hug spot. I thought he had a great looking bear hug. You know, just like he would cinch up on it and wouldn't make it just look like a rest hold. And you know, I
remember when China grabbed Marlena and just throttled her. I mean, here's like 100 pounds of Terry Runnels being held, and China's just whipping her back and forth. It was violent looking.
You think that could have been a finisher?
Could have been China's finisher.
Just whipping back and forth.
Like, if you, I'm sure you've seen it. Like, it is just, she is whipping her like it's a, like a blow up doll. That's what Terry Runnels looks like. She is just rotating at such violent force. Thought like her body might explode. So the bear hug kills Kane. And this would lead to, because the Undertaker was off at this point, and he would return in September. And Mark Henry was the chosen opponent that they were going to build up all summer long to go on last at the Unforgiven pay-per-view with the Undertaker. Hmm. And the results were not pretty.
Hmm.
But we move on. Haas and Benjamin are being treated along with the Hardys in the very same room. I mean, this doesn't seem like a wise idea, does it?
I mean, what do you want? Like two separate rooms for medical?
Of course.
I don't think they even
have Florida Commission. I mean, letting guys in with concussions.
They don't even have that in the UFC.
Well,
it's just one doctor.
They're separated, though, afterwards. I mean, they don't put them in the same room together.
But if the doctor is at one, they go for their medicals all in the same place.
Speaking of MMA, which I just love to shoehorn into every conversation,
yeah.
Do you know what infamous fight took place the night before this pay-per-view? Took place at the
2007, June. I don't know, Couture, Sylvia.
Nope. It was Minsoo Kim.
Oh,
and Brock Lesnar.
There you go,
Brock's debut.
Very cool.
So they argue, and then they brawled. So they'll have another match after this. We assume the ladder match just wasn't enough to settle the score between these four. Then we had a video on the McMahon-Lashley feud, including Vince pinning him to win the title with help from Umaga. And this was Vince McMahon's do-rag phase.
Oh, man, what a visual here. Vince McMahon in a do-rag with the ECW championship. And this is not the new ECW champion. This is the original ECW championship.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, what a great visual.
This was after Vince had lost his hair at WrestleMania. And
the do-rag phase.
The do-rag phase.
I love this action figure. Vince in a do-rag with the ECW title.
Ugh. So we had Vince McMahon against Bobby Lashley in a street fight for the ECW title. Shane McMahon and Umaga are in the corner of Vince McMahon. And Vince gets into the ring, and he's just doing these weak stretches, pulling at the middle rope prior to the smash.
This is so funny. He's so funny.
Like, he was beyond a caricature of himself in 2007. He was just so goofy over the top in 2007. And this whole match, I'm just watching this and watching Lashley have to sell for him, thinking this could have been Bob Sapp and Vince McMahon. Because this was the role Bob Sapp was pegged for, and he wouldn't sign. And then Lashley kind of inherited what they had planned for Bob Sapp. Lashley almost died during the opening of this match. He went for this flip over the top, I guess to one-up Rob Van Dam's move from earlier. And he just rotated all the way over, taking out Umaga. And all he caught of Umaga was with the back of his boot.
Yeah.
I can't believe this guy got up and wasn't crippled.
He went for a suicide dive himself, but for some reason held on or got caught up in the ropes and just flipped.
Oh my God.
Almost the reverse of the Shelton Benjamin.
Yeah, it was.
But except he was diving to the outside.
I can't believe there wasn't more long-term damage incurred by some of the talent on this show.
For some reason, they decided... I understood why they replayed the Shelton spot, because it actually worked out. But for some reason, they decided to replay this.
This one just made Lashley look like an idiot.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that.
Lashley then attacks Shane and tosses him over the top to Umaga on the floor and finally attacks Vince. And as Lashley is on top attacking Vince McMahon, Joey Styles, the voice of ECW, yells, "This is what ECW and WWE fans all wanted to see." This couldn't be further from the truth. This was the brand of ECW crawling into a hole and burying itself 6 feet under, because this was the end of ECW. Umaga gets sent into a post in the corner, then stops Shane with a chair, goes for a running power slam, but Umaga attacks him. Shane then hits a DDT onto the chair, and Lashley is down. We got some of the weakest offense you are ever going to see in a WWE title match from Vince, as he sends Lashley to the floor. Then he chokes him with the hammer that they use for the ring bell, and then grabs a cable, and Vince McMahon starts choking Lashley. Had this been 3 years later, Vince McMahon would have been fired for choking a man with an inanimate object. Then there's a Samoan drop hit by Umaga in the ring. Vince gets a two count. It's pretty much a handicap match at this point.
It always was. The whole story is just them, you know, technically it's a one-on-one match, but because there are no rules, Vince is basically turning it into a three-on-one.
I'm convinced that McMahon hired the Sandman just so there could be an argument of who was more unathletic between these two, because damn, is there an argument between Vince and Jim Fullington.
Shane was like really the workhorse here. Shane and Umaga, of course.
But. Dude, Umaga was... Man, was that guy good.
Yeah, he's very good. But Shane here was like... Basically, the match is Vince with his two enforcers as guards, basically keeping him away from Lashley the whole match. And Umaga, I understand, but like Shane McMahon is positioned as an enforcer on the equal level of an Umaga here.
Like, I'm serious. Shane McMahon could be inserted into any backyard across the country, and he would fit in perfectly well.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, he's so little natural talent and just a propensity to fall from high places and do anything asked or that he could think of.
Yeah, he does, like, land his spots well. I mean, you know, with the everything looks good enough, but not much of an actual wrestler. But, yeah, he can jump off of things and land
pretty great. Well. Vince speared Bobby Lashley for a two count. Your high-level wrestler getting double-legged by Vince. Then Vince would take a splash. He would make a comeback. The crowd was getting into this for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Lashley then nailed Vince with a chair shot to the head. Oh, the times are changing. And then more shots to the back. He hits a Dominator, which was a running power slam. Umaga pulls him to the floor. There's a super kick to Lashley. Then Lashley is placed on the announce desk, and Shane climbs to the top and nails this elbow drop off the top, putting Lashley through the announce desk. Vince still only gets a two count from this as they put Lashley back into the ring. Umaga hits his running hip attack into the corner, which is what the Usos always do. And JBL will always say, "Shades of their daddy Rikishi." And the Usos have pointed out, no, that's a tribute spot to our uncle Umaga, not Rikishi. Then they got a garbage can as Shane got set for the Van Terminator, but Lashley got out of the way at the last second, and Shane would miss with the Van Terminator, staggered up, took a spear. Vince gets up and takes a spear, and then Lashley pins Vince at 12 minutes, 24 seconds, and then speared Vince a second time. This was the definition of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for what it was, the crowd did enjoy this for the stunt nature of what this was.
Like so many Vince McMahon matches before this, I don't think there's any I don't think he could, certainly doesn't consider himself a professional wrestler. And so you know that they're going to book their way around his limitations and they're going to go all out. And I thought they planned a pretty good match here considering all the participants involved. I mean, you know, it was really just, it was Vince hiding behind these two other people, and Lashley trying to get at Vince, but having to go through these two other people. And I thought they told a pretty clear story there. You know, I thought Shane's high spots were added kind of garnish to the match. Umaga looked very good. Vince's weaknesses were well hidden. And, you know, I thought there was really not that much to complain about here.
Santino Marella is with Maria in the back. This was the start of their romance as they were teasing it. When Todd Grisham comes in and he is asking Maria for her technical breakdown of the pudding match. And Maria says, "I love pudding." And Todd had the best reaction. "That's awesome." He said it in such a dismissive tone.
The future ESPN reporter.
Todd Grisham he's a very funny individual, if you've heard this man in his natural element. And then Maria goes into this super scientific breakdown of a pudding match.
"I think that it really depends on the viscosity of the pudding and the way that the competitors adapt to it. Obviously, factors such as temperature and visibility will play a major role. But in order to win, one must be susceptible to any and all X factors involved in a match such as this. So, does that answer your question, Todd?"
Including the viscosity of the pudding and what the temperature will play in terms of a factor. And then Candace walks in. She says she's going to win any type of match with Melina, and then asks Santino for a good luck kiss. But as she closes her eyes, it's Maria who comes in and kisses Candace, leading to Ron Simmons walking in and yelling, "Damn." A punchline that the company still thinks is funny 8 years later.
I think it's still funny. It doesn't appear that often. Not in this scenario. I mean, honestly, it just played out like a porn scene, like the beginning of a porn scene. Like, the level of acting was that bad. And I think the attempts at, you know, sexuality were just so
lame.
Yeah, just easy and not good.
So up next, we had Give Divas a Chance. Melina and Candace.
"King, we're going to have some dessert before our final 2 minute events.
Oh, baby, check that out.
Pudding.
Pudding.
You like pudding?
Do I like pudding? I love pudding. With a little whipped cream, a cherry on top. Oh, man.
The following is a Diva pudding match being contested in a pool of pudding. And it can be won by pinfall or submission."
I believe this was a non-title pudding match, because Melina was the champion at this point, no. But I don't believe the title was up for grabs in a pudding match. What a way to drop the belt.
Yeah.
Melina came out wearing goggles for this pudding match.
No.
I guess not realizing that this is a solid, like, liquid that you will not be able to see through. True. Once it covers your eyes. But
still don't want it in your eyes, though.
I guarantee you that this somehow related, because Trish Stratus did one of these matches and she legit had to get her eyes flushed out after the match.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that was a story Melina had heard and thus was going to wear the goggles. Unfortunately, she had to ditch them halfway through this match because she couldn't see anything. It's not like she was going in water.
Yeah.
So this match was just so stupid.
We've heard pretty much the gamut of Jim Ross's calls in the past few weeks. We heard him in Great American Bash 1990. We heard him at the King of the Ring 1993. Even Attitude Era JR. But this might have been Jim Ross at his
most uninterested.
Yeah, most dismissive.
Lawler, on the other hand, was just, he couldn't wait for this.
To be honest, I don't even know how much he would have been into it at this point. This was 2007.
His money line was, "The proof is in the pudding," that you know he took some great joy in delivering, and spent all of 3 seconds before waiting to unleash that one on us. And then in just one of those lines that was completely innocuous at the time, but today means something totally different and is taken much more worse than it was intended to be. Lawler asks if we need Bill Cosby to come out and call this match.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy. Jim Ross somehow segued from this match, because it was taking place in Florida, to the fact that you can watch old episodes of Florida Championship Wrestling on WWE 24/7, their new on-demand service. Lawler then says that you should always practice safe eating and always use condiments. This is when Melina removes her goggles. She hit a DDT to Candace. Candace then tries to drown her. Tries to drown her in the pudding, and Melina taps from suffocation at 2:59.
She taps on the surface of the pudding, which I don't know if I've ever seen a tap out occur on the surface of like a liquid. I don't know if that necessarily, I guess it counts here.
This was the most, like, there were, like, unprotected shots to the head. There were, like, concussion angles. But nothing to me felt more outdated than this on this particular show for me. And, you know, there was a time that this was just considered a staple of wrestling in the late 90s, early 2000s. And this is just...
Not even in the early 2000s. You remember the whole HLA period on Raw, and that already seemed very desperate and very sad.
Like, this was beyond just dated to me. This was like... It was degrading to watch hey, you two women, this is what we have planned for you tonight. That you are going to go out and roll around in pudding.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, to me, I just had no place for this in any year. And this was just, you compare that to how they are, I mean, look at the NXT division at this point, and this.
Oh, don't even mention
that. That is, though, a branch of where this was.
Not even the same sentence.
Hey, this is kind of how they viewed women 8 years ago and their placement.
Yeah, this was just a very weak attempt at, you know, PG-13 sexuality without trying to rekindle, I think, you know, what they thought attracted people to their product back in 97. It was just more gross than, like, it was actually disgusting. It looked gross than sexy. And what was I going to say? You couldn't even tell which girl was which because they were both covered in chocolate.
I'm glad I wasn't the only one who had that issue. I didn't know which was which either. At first, I thought Melina had won the match, and it was Candace. Maria then comes out to interview her. Everyone gets tossed into the pudding, including the referee Marty Elias, who is now a referee for Lucha Underground.
Great.
Did you know? Did you care?
Nope.
Edge and Batista had to follow that in a steel cage match. Cole notes that Batista's hamstring is not taped up. Take note. Edge immediately tries to escape. Batista applies a camel clutch, and JBL notes that this is shades of Gory Guerrero, which I almost guarantee was a play off of a famous locker room story. Because you look at the camel clutch, most modern fans think Iron Sheik probably. When, in fact, it was Gory Guerrero who introduced that, and there was a famous story in 2005 when Eddie Guerrero did this on television. And Muhammad Hassan had the gall to go up to Eddie Guerrero and tell him to quit using that move on TV. And you can imagine how that endeared Muhammad Hassan to the locker room in 2005. So that's what I instantly thought of when JBL brought this comparison point of the camel clutch to Gory Guerrero.
I love that story. Great story. Justice.
Bro, knock it off with that camel clutch.
Mm-hmm.
Batista climbs, he gets drop-kicked in the knee and falls down and then gets speared into the cage. The ribs are attacked by Edge. At one point, Cole is, I guess, being critical of JBL's commentary of him as doing play-by-play. And JBL tells him not to step on him and his color commentary and just basically called Michael Cole an idiot at one point.
Both feet have to touch the floor to win the championship.
Thank you for reiterating the point I just made.
The color commentary, don't make a step on me, idiot.
This is a very different JBL than what we see today. JBL at this point was much more antagonistic as a commentator, and I think he was also, you know, tried, I'll say he seems to try harder at this point. You know what I mean? To come up with logical defenses for the heels. These days, he really doesn't do that.
He's Michael Cole's buddy now. I mean, they'll have like these fake arguments that you never really believe they're at odds, whereas at this time they would frequently just go at it with a defined babyface heel dynamic. The top turnbuckle padding is pulled off, and Batista hit a superplex, got a two count. Batista's trying to climb and escape, but then hits a shoulder block off the top, but gets hit by an Edge dropkick in midair. Edge slingshots him into the cage, goes for another roll-up, and then as Edge is trying to climb, he's stopped on the top, gets pulled back, but then low blows Batista and crotches him on the top rope. Edge is climbing over as Batista is lunging for the door, and Edge's feet touch before Batista's can on the floor as Batista touches with his hands but not his feet, and therefore Edge is declared the winner at 15:38, and Edge leaves through the crowd as Batista's trying to go after him, and Batista just stares at the title, which is left behind on the announce desk, staring at his lost reward.
Crying.
Very, very prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
And this would continue. These guys had a lengthy feud. I think they went through like four consecutive pay-per-views or something together. It was quite the feud they had on SmackDown.
I thought the match was good. Physical.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's about what I would categorize it as.
Yeah.
And then our main event, setting things up, was Great Khali pinning John Cena on the prior Saturday night's main event after John Cena had pinned Khali at the prior Judgment Day pay-per-view, but Khali had his foot under the bottom rope, the escape clause. So tonight would be a Falls Count Anywhere match for the WWE title and kind of another smoke and mirrors match to work around the limitations of the Great Khali. And Jim Ross says that John Cena's got to fight tonight like his hair is on fire.
Hmm.
What an analogy.
Okay. Well.
I can't say if my hair was on fire that that would create this urgency in my fighting skill.
No.
Like, if anything, I would be attacking my head and trying to put out my hair. But what a weird saying. I've never heard that in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Fight like your hair is on fire.
Have you heard the saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Have you heard that one?
Is that like you're trying to tackle something big and you just break it down?
Yeah, I heard that one used recently, and I had a similar reaction. Like, oh, what a strange, strange saying.
He never differentiated what hair.
Okay. Would it make a difference if it was his pubic hair that was on fire?
Oh, this is that old that song. And
if great, his pubic hair
great balls of fire.
If his pubic hair feels like it's on fire, I'd probably rush to the doctor.
If my hair was on fire, I mean, look what happened to Harry in Home Alone. Blowtorch to the head.
Michael Jackson.
True.
Probably fought pretty crazy on that set.
Yeah, so I don't know. Jim Ross's next term was bowling shoe ugly to describe the Great Khali's offense. Didn't even give him like a minute into the match before Ross clearly outlined what we were watching.
They were quick to also, you know, say that even though this stuff looks terrible, it has the effectiveness of a man 10 times the size of what you'd typically see, you know, doing one of these chops or punches.
Well, that was the, you know, the strength of Great Khali is that he is this untrained giant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this guy should not be doing technical wrestling ever.
Yeah.
I don't care if he can. He shouldn't be doing it.
I wouldn't say that being untrained is necessarily a strength. Certainly, I think if his punches looked better, it probably helped add to the effectiveness of the perception. But the announcers and Cena himself here was just, from the get-go, selling like crazy for these punches.
I know John Cena, he gets a lot of flack from people over the years about, you know, he doesn't wear traditional wrestling boots and trunks. These goofy white sneakers.
Were they pumps?
They were pumps.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like something out of like an 80s like pop music video or something. They look terrible. They're like, who puts these on their top star and says, go out there? These things, I hated these shoes.
Who puts anything on John Cena and says, go out there? But yet somehow people buy this shit. People buy his shirts.
No, I'm saying the shoes. I'm complaining about the shoes.
I'm sure if he sold John Cena shoes, kids would buy those.
I can't
believe
they haven't marketed John Cena shoes yet. So he's out there. Khali drops him, stomps him, stands on his head at one point, and Cena. This was maybe the most ambitious move Great Khali ever pulled off. He hit a reverse spin kick. like a fucking, like, and landed it okay.
Reverse spin kick. How high did he get?
Like, enough that it connected with Cena's chest.
Okay, so not didn't reach for the head.
He wasn't in the head, but just, I mean,
were his legs 90 degrees, past 90 degrees above his waist, or at waist level?
It was above the waist. Okay. It was above the waist. Impressive. Like, hit him in the heart.
Cool.
This was the best spot Khali has ever landed. Khali then missed him on the mat. Cena then goes for this forward flip into a neck breaker. I don't know what it was. I'll be nice and call it a face buster. It looked horrible. Cena then climbed the turnbuckle and gets chopped to the floor. Then he gets stood on top on the floor for a two count. Cena blocks the chop of death, which I just loved. I love that Khali. You just chop a guy like tomahawk chop to the head.
I'm sure it would actually hurt, too.
Of course it would. Beat the Undertaker with this thing. And Cena then gets sent over the barricade. He attacks Cena in the audience. They fight by the production area. Cena then attacks him with a monitor, but can't lift him up for the FU at the time. Then he misses Cena with a strike and goes into this production case. And Cena then swings a jib crane into the Great Khali, but he wouldn't stay down.
First two cranes in this match.
That's right. Yeah, there were many cranes. Great Khali, with that balance, might have been able to pull off the crane.
Like a crane kick.
They fight on the crane, which is part of the set. Cena blocks a tree slam and then lifts him up and hits an FU off the crane to the floor, where you just see Khali land and his leg dive in the air. Mm-hmm. And Cena gets the fall. 10 minutes, 28 seconds. They tried to keep this match as simple as humanly possible.
Yeah.
It was all Cena selling. It was built around one bump at the end. And everyone cheered for Cena throughout this match. And this was certainly, like, people booed the hell out of John Cena by 2007. We were well into that phase of his career. And this was largely a crowd that responded to John Cena, the babyface, who overcame the big giant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely felt like this was probably about as good of a match as you could get out of the Great Khali with John Cena, and I thought Cena did a pretty good job here, just selling. They built up to that FU pretty well, and it did look very impressive coming off of that elevated platform onto this guy that's this big.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to call this main event a great match by any stretch, but if you're
going to sell Cena versus Khali, I think this was about as better as high of an expectation as you could expect.
This was about the height of what you could imagine these two could get out of. And smart on their part to not try and make this your 20-minute main event, because it has to go 20 in the main event. 10 minutes was fine. No one had any problem with it.
No.
If they'd gone any longer, they probably would have died a death out there.
No, an impressive visual to end the match. That's all. I think people were satisfied with this.
A fine main event, an average show, I thought, and that one gives... I give this one a 5 out of 10. I just thought it was a very average show with probably very little expectation going in. And, you know, if you watch it, a good show, not a show you have to go out of your way to go back and make sure you watch.
I think it's a show, you know, with a couple matches that show how, you know, with gimmicks, you can hide a lot of weaknesses, and with just effective booking, you can, I don't know, dude, I don't even know what I want to say. It's just one of those shows where that kind of exists, but I think it was well done. I think they booked everything, you know, sensibly, is that a word? I give it a 6 out of 10.
It's the kind of show where you wake up the next morning, you forget it, and you move on. Like the appropriately named title of this show. All right. We're going to get into the time machine, and we're going to listen to a clip from The Law from the night of June 3rd, 2007, where Dan Lavransky chatted with Dave Meltzer just an hour after One Night Stand for a real-time look at how this show was received that evening in 2007. To give everyone the context, Wei Ting called Dave Meltzer, and then I probably challenged Wei to small talk for 90 seconds and way past with flying colors.
Did I?
As you always did.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't have that much to say, you know. And Dave, I know, is just waiting to go on, so there's not much small talk. It's just more like, hey, Dave, how's it going? It's Law. Yeah, we're about to come on. Okay, great. See ya. But it was as simple as that.
So now you've got the full feel of how this call was set up. And now we'll hear the call.
This would be the interaction every single week for like years between me and Dave Meltzer.
My favorite conversations. Yeah. All right. Here he is, Dave Meltzer on the Law from June 3rd, 2007.
We're going to be joined by Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, but there's too much product.
Yeah. Well, just look at WWE alone this past week, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
There's like 10 hours or something.
Yeah, well, you know, if there was anything this weekend made clear, it's that Saturday night main event doesn't need to be there.
No. No. And whereas, you know, when I was in high school and that was like such a big event, but now it was just another bump in the road.
Well, to me, you know, when there was a purpose for it because things were completely different, but now I think it works against the purpose because they're already, everyone there is already overworked, and now it gives them another hour and a half of, of somewhat stuff that they have to put in. And you can see just from every TV show, from an idea standpoint, they're really low right now on ideas, and they're just, you know, doing, you know, matches upon matches to make up for the fact that there's really no new ideas. I'm not knocking it, but it's just, I mean, no, who can do it? Who can do this week? You had four TV shows. I mean, with the pay-per-view tonight.
Yeah.
Actually, what's your 1, 2, 3? Is it 5?
So,
it's 5. That's even worse.
Yeah, it's it was a lot for 1 week. Let's talk a little bit about tonight's one-night stand pay-per-view. First off, they had RVD win that opening match with Orton. Is he sticking around now till the end of his contract, Dave? Because we all thought he was ending tonight.
No. I'll know for sure in the morning, but I'm almost positive that this was his final night. I think we talked about this, that it was interesting watching the crowd because you notice, like, unlike like with Lesnar and Goldberg and some of these guys that on their last night where you could see that the people knew, this crowd didn't know.
That's right.
And Vince booked. I had heard that Vince was furious because he thought the whole world knew it was last night, and that he was thinking about doing a swerve, and obviously he did do the swerve with RVD winning. But you know, now it's like the joke's on him. It's like, oh, why did you even bother? But that was to surprise. You know, I'd written about it a couple times. You know, there might be a swerve. But as far as I know, that's RVD's swan song.
So they won't have Orton beat him again in a couple of weeks or whatever.
It's possible. I don't know why. You know, I mean, it looked like a good injury angle, but it is possible. He's because he was at one point the idea of asking him to stay two more weeks to swerve people was thrown out there.
Right. Interesting. And it's too bad. It's too bad as well because I thought it was actually not a bad match.
Yeah, match was fine. I thought that it was, I don't know, at the finish I thought was kind of weak.
Right.
But, it was good. I mean, you know, everybody worked hard tonight.
I want to talk about the one guy that seemed to work amazingly hard was Shelton Benjamin. Yeah. What was up with Benjamin in that match? Did Jeff Hardy say, I'm not taking any bumps, so Shelton decided to take them all?
We all know that they need some guys to step up. And guys are always told, you got to step up.
Right.
He stepped up. Now, let's see if he gets rewarded in the next couple weeks.
Yeah. Well, that's if he doesn't, then he better watch it. Because, I mean, some of the punishment he gave his body tonight was insane.
That backdrop on the ladder.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, I know.
Yeah, absolutely
but
crazy.
All, you know, all those guys worked so hard. They had, you knew it was going to be a great match going in, and it was a great match.
They worked so hard, Dave. They had the crowd totally going nuts, and then Mark Henry and Kane came out and just leveled everything off.
Hey, I tell you what, though. If you're going to follow them, you might as well follow them with that match as opposed to following them with, like, an important match.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. What else did I want to check on here with? It looks like the thing's done with McMahon, and now is McMahon and Shane hopefully going to fade out now that Lashley's got the title again? Or
I don't know.
I hope so.
They're so weak on depth that I don't know what they're going to
do.
I mean, it certainly was booked when I watched it. It's like, okay, that's the way Vince likes to lead his program. But anything's. You know, if you really look at the house show lineups and just the TVs the last few weeks, the depth, those injuries, that Michaels injury and Undertaker injury, You know, and Kennedy injury and all that. They've really been killers.
They really have been. And I have to ask quickly, too, what's up with the Santino Marella? It just seems like they give him that spectacular win in Italy, and now he just seems to be like a footnote already.
Yeah, they didn't follow it up for like 2 weeks, I think, afterwards. And then by the time they followed it up, I think all the momentum was gone.
Yeah.
And the last couple of times I've seen him on TV, there was no reaction. And when you're a new character and they give you a little push and you get no reaction, you know, they give up real fast. And I think, he's kind of been given up on.
They certainly did. Now, we'll talk more about this next Sunday because the draft show is next Monday. But just I wanted to see if you've heard anything, Dave, on potential who's going where.
Speculate all the mid-card guys, but that need a change in scenery.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to speculate because the way they are, I mean, I've heard some names, but the bottom line is they change their minds on an hourly basis. I mean,
what about the championship status, Dave? Like, I would assume the Edge stays on SmackDown, Lashley stays on ECW.
I guess. I mean, we've seen that move, too. I mean, if one of them moves, then two of them got to move. You got to figure.
Well, that's what I'm wondering if the champs stay where they are or if they all get moved around.
Well, we know Cena's not going to ECW.
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah.
You know
who's going to be in ECW? Jay and I have decided that everybody that was in the Lumberjacks tonight, they're going to be the ECW roster.
Oh, boy,
except for Benoit. Then the rest of them will all be in ECW.
Yeah, I saw those guys, and I was just like, wow. What was Benoit doing there?
Terrible.
It was almost like a kiss of death.
It was terrible. It's bad enough that they substituted his match with MVP with Mark Henry versus Kane, but to stick him in there with the Lumberjacks, yeah, that was not a good thing to see.
I wonder what he's done because he's such a he's one of those guys that no one ever says anything bad about
at all. That's right.
So the whole thing of him, the whole thing of like losing the two straight falls and then getting taken off the next pay-per-view, and it's like you go like, what did he do? Because he didn't do anything wrong, and he works as hard as anyone, and he's real popular for a mid-card guy who gets no push.
Yeah, yeah, it's very, very strange.
Didn't that bring back memories?
No, I don't remember any of this. I don't remember seeing the show at all.
That's the best part about these reviews. Even shows you've seen, it's like you're watching them for the first time.
I had no idea.
I can't say I remembered much from this card either. Okay, feedback time. We got quite a bit of it. Say what you will about 2007. These people remembered it. Josh from Auburn Hills is first. I thought that John Cena's one-year reign was great, but felt they ran out of opponents for him at points. I fell off of wrestling at this time, but truly regret missing the TV at this time. John, do you have an idea on who was on the creative team for all three brands? Oh, this definitely Court was at this point in time in 2007. David Lagana was still there in 2007. I want to say... I'm trying to remember. I don't know exact time periods of when creative team members were in and out. There's a high churn rate. No, this was after that December to Dismember fallout. So Heyman had been sent home by this point. So he had nothing to do with ECW at this point. So it would have been...
Corpse?
I think it was Lagana doing ECW. Michael Hayes was on SmackDown. And Raw would have been... Gortz and other rotating team members and such at this point.
There should be credits. Really.
There should be on. I'm not even joking. I think if I was a writer for WWE, for the hours you put in, Christ, I'd want a credit at the end.
Would you credit them as writers or producers?
They probably wouldn't. They'd be weird about terms like that.
Yeah. Okay, we go to Gonzalo from Minneapolis. I love the show. Back at the team... Back at the time, he means. Although, by the end of the month, it would be the darkest day in WWW history.
The internet was going crazy.
I've never understood the point of getting away from the Hammerstein Ballroom for this show, but with all three brands, I guess I know why.
This show would have died at the Hammerstein Ballroom. Can you imagine the balls to give you Cena and Khali? Putting that at Hammerstein?
Hold on a second, though. Imagine Vince McMahon walking out with a do-rag and the ECW belt in
that room. That would have been great.
Awesome.
That actually would have been great. But Lashley wouldn't have been the right opponent to take the title back. John from Indianapolis. Glad this is a review instead of Hardcore Heaven 2000 because I remember this show.
I remember the build of this well because I finally got into wrestling at the beginning of 2007, just a week before No Way Out. I was somewhat in mark mode during this time, admittingly, but looking back at it now, it had all the telltale signs of a weak product. The Great Khali saw the end of his protection as a scary giant during the Super Cena run in a rather sloppy match, which ironically, for Khali's standards, was one of his best performances, and actually made me think the big guy... It actually made me like the big guy since he took a pretty sick bump at the end of the show. They also were about ready to give up on Bobby Lashley, even though they booked him through three pay-per-views of three-on-one handicap matches. Lashley would present himself as a viable champion 7 years later, when he was both presented as an unstoppable heel and also given mouthpieces, because the best Lashley could do on the mic during his WWE run was, "You bath turd." Can't say I remember that line with any kind of... Okay. Remembrance.
You say your name is Finley and you love to fight. I say your name is Finley and you're a bastard.
Wow. Can't say that.
All right.
I love the fact that you read it.
The Listen, I'm doing my best here.
It's so funny. Okay, we got Alan Jones who says, I had higher hopes for this show than it delivers. While the opener was very good, the rest of the card left something to be desired. Cena got a better match out of Khali than I ever expected. It comes down to this. The good was really good and the bad was really bad. The Hardys once again delivered and along with the world's greatest tag team put on the match of the night. Most matches were fine. The pudding match and lumberjack matches were what you expected and possibly worse. Not horrible. Some hard work and a lot of potential saved a lot of things. I just feel that sometimes you need to give the guys some rope. Either they use it to their advantage or they hang themselves. But they need to have the chance.
Oh. Christian, to me, 2007 was John Cena's breakout year in terms of his in-ring work. He was fantastic all year long until his injury later in the year. I think the same can be said for Batista, although you could argue that he got given the right opponents in Taker and Edge for pretty much the entire year. As for this show, RVD winning the opener made little sense to me as this was his last show and Orton would be in the title picture for the next few months. Lumberjack match succeeded in making all the Lumberjacks look useless as Kane and Mark Henry just overpowered them from the start. Also, the pudding match was just there to show how dated this show is, as I can't imagine WWE even thinking of doing a match like that these days. Honestly, those are my only negatives to this show. I really liked a lot of the matches in terms of ring work and felt the final two really delivered. I also love JBL on commentary.
Brad from Whitby, what was Val Venis doing during the Henry and Kane match? He was going absolutely nuts on the outside, acting out the widest range of emotions I've ever seen from someone who has nothing invested in this match. Michael Cole said that Mark Henry's back was as big as a billboard. Yeah, a billboard for man Spanx. Why was Vince covered in black from head to toe? Was this a down period for Mr. McMahon and his six-time Putski-winning body? His son pretty much took over this match, and with his stupid dance, dumb shirt, and a necessary look-what-I-can-do high spots. I always wanted those shirts to piss on.
Andrew McDonald, I do remember the show, but I'll be honest, I was hoping you guys would pick something older. However, when I thought about it more, I realized, yes, this event took place 8 years ago. I know this has been beaten like a drum on the show, but there has been almost no aesthetic changes to the product in some time. That one could say this show may have happened 6 months to a year ago. Anyway, I found the show kind of boring. The two highlights for me were the stellar but seemingly forgotten ladder match and the lumberjack match. Sure, the lumberjack match was pretty rotten, but I love seeing the random roster members from that era. The match was so bad, I think Val Venis put in more effort on the outside of the ring than Kane or Mark Henry did inside of it. Every era seems to be pretty interesting and different, be it the late 80s boom, the Attitude Era, or WCW 2000. They all seem to be somewhat different, but everything from the past 10 years seems to be exactly the same, and it's sad that pro wrestling had gotten to this point. I'm sure I liked the show at the time, but I'll have to give the show a 4 out of 10.
We got a bill from Hamilton. Edge and Batista just never clicked. Not as if their matches were bad by any means, but they never seemed to get out of first gear whenever they faced each other. The Vince McMahon ECW champion angle is the type of thing that makes me think at times they do like to troll the smart marks. And to top it off, one of the many accomplishments of Cena's career was getting a watchable match out of the Great Khali.
Randy in Australia, after watching Extreme Rules a couple of months ago, I was thinking that the stop-start nature of last man standing in chain matches sucked all the drama out of these matches and made them the worst of all gimmick matches. One Night Stand had some great gimmick matches. The ladder match and Falls Count Anywhere came across really well, and these might be two of my favorite gimmick match types. What do you guys think are the best and worst gimmick or special matches that WWE does? Are there any stipulation matches that still stand out for you that you get? I think always when you have stakes attached to them, I think that's why people care about Money in the Bank, because there's something of importance at stake, much like the Royal Rumble every year. Those are, to me, matches that, beyond just a match in and of itself, there is something larger to it, that there's importance behind it.
For sure, for sure. I think as something as simple as, you know, even a cage match, which is one of the oldest stipulation matches, I think still has a lot of value. It's an impressive visual. Yeah, like you say, you know, it has to make sense for the gimmick. And nothing on a pole. I don't know if I've ever enjoyed any type of pole match. It just sounds funny. Like, it's okay for comedy, I suppose.
Well, it's a punchline now.
Yeah. Blank on a pole, you know. I hate, like, ambulance matches. I hate, like, I'm not even a big fan of casket matches. You know, anytime where you got to place somebody into something and close a box or close a door, I find them kind of awkward.
We have one more here.
Our last piece of feedback comes from, what's this guy's name?
Jack
from Vancouver, who has a question. I was listening to an old episode of Review Raw from 2012, and you guys were having an argument about jobbing out a guy before giving him a title. John made the point that nobody in UFC history has ever received the title fight coming off a loss. Is the upcoming Gus versus Cormier fight the very first time this has happened, as it happened sometime in the last 3 years? Ignore Couture versus Sylvia, as it was special circumstances.
Couture's had a few occasions, but some of them extenuating circumstances, such as that one. It's happened before.
Yeah,
of guys
coming in as replacements. You know, like, was Nick Diaz coming off of a loss?
Yep, Nick Diaz was. Misha Tate was when she fought Ronda Rousey the second time. Chael Sonnen was when he fought John Jones.
Basically, people just run out of mostly name value opponents to put people up against.
Here's the difference, though, between, you know, in mixed martial arts, they wouldn't, if the UFC had their pick of things, would they like Alexander Gustafsson to be coming off a nice win streak?
Of course.
Like, is that even a question?
Yeah, you wouldn't job Gustafsson out.
So when you apply it to professional wrestling, I think that's why, I know some people hate when we make the comparison points.
Why would you add that extra handicap when you don't have to?
Exactly. You're only creating this barrier for people to put their heads over to try and understand why this is happening and to get into a challenger. And it's like, another staple is the fact that, you know, we go to a guy's hometown and it's viewed as, this is a great opportunity to get heat on a guy. We're going to beat him in his hometown. And it's like, you watch, you know, throw Dustin Poirier on Saturday night. He cuts the greatest promo after about being home in Louisiana, and this crowd goes insane for him. It's like, bring up the case of a wrestler that benefited long-term from, he goes back to his hometown where he had been humiliated the last time, and this heel has this incredible heat, versus positioning a guy as a hometown hero, like Punk was coming into Money in the Bank every time they went to Chicago after that year. This guy was treated like God in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, to me, when you control the outcomes, it's like you can avoid everything that a company that doesn't hold the ability to work finishes, they struggle with. They wish that they could put a guy on a 5-fight win streak and put together the ultimate win streak. Like, they would love Cormier to just go through all these guys and you have this great fight with John Jones, but the realistic fact is Bader could beat Daniel Cormier, and then you have a John Jones Daniel Ryan Bader fight.
Boy,
you don't care at all.
Of course I care. I think you're making a great point.
I think when you simplify things, it's like, why would you create your own problems for yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think there's something to be said about being too predictable, but I don't think that anybody's ever complained you know, about something like a babyface losing in the hometown, and or if a babyface wins the hometown, I don't know how many people will complain that this was too predictable, that this guy would win.
I never buy that argument. You know, with John Cena and Kevin Owens, logic would tell you what is the only finish that makes sense for this debuting heel against your babyface. Like, what other finish than Owens winning makes sense? Did anyone bank on Owens winning that match? Not at all. Everyone was surprised at the end when Owens wins this match. And I don't care what scenario it is, it's going to be the same this Sunday of people just assuming Cena gets his win back, even though for the most longevity, Owens winning makes so much more sense. So that idea of, oh, it's so predictable, a lot of times people like predictable because that means you're telling a story. You're trying to anticipate what is the next story.
Well, at the end of any movie, we know that the good guy's going to win. At the end of any TV show, we know the good guy's going to win. It's just about how you get there. That's where you bring in the suspense. That's where you impress. That's where you, you know, draw attention. I don't think, like, at the end of Breaking Bad, we know...
Be careful.
I'm not going to... Dude, it's been like 3 years. You've seen
it. Hey, man. I'm
fine,
in favor.
Whatever. At the end of... what's an older movie?
You know a movie I watched on the weekend?
What?
Nightcrawler.
How was that?
You need to see this.
Why?
Because if you suddenly became super evil, you'd be the main character.
Why is that?
He goes around and just shoots like crime footage and stuff and then would sell it to the local news station. And he's like concerned with framing and production quality.
Okay. The camera.
I'd be your sidekick in this. He has a sidekick as well in it.
Hmm.
Who, I mean, I hope you would be a better person to me than this guy. But this movie's awesome.
Okay.
It's
anyway,
great.
So at the end of this movie, I assume... I don't even want to... I'm so scared of
the point is, Randy Orton and Rob Van Dam, that finish, probably most people didn't see coming. And how did that benefit you? For this guy that was going to headline SummerSlam for the title, losing, because some people on the internet might know the finish. So we're going to sacrifice basic storytelling to surprise people. And that is stuff I hate. Mm-hmm. You can surprise people. I just want it to make sense at the end. You can do swerves, and then it's even more rewarding if it all makes sense at the end.
If it's a good story.
There's hints dropped. There's reasons for this. People will never see it coming. I hate that defense. It's such a crutch to do anything you think of with no responsibility to your audience.
Yeah. Well said.
That's going to end. I am so tired right now. I'm out. I'm going to sleep after this. Thanks for doing this review with me, Wei.
No problem.
It's fun as always.
Anytime.
Thank you to Dave Meltzer from 8 years ago.
Anytime you want me around, just give me a shout.
Every week.
Oh, maybe.
Next week, you want to go the documentary route. I can't even talk right now, so why don't you let us know what I'm watching next week?
Next week, we are reviewing the Daniel Bryan Just Say Yes.
Yes.
Blu-ray DVD that just came out today.
Blu-ray or DVD. Can't have both of them together.
Okay.
Do you have a Blu-ray player?
At home I do. I don't even know. But I can't say I have any Blu-rays at all.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who does.
Yeah.
I never hear people say I want to pick up a Blu-ray.
There are certainly people that I think like to collect still. But most of everything I have is just on a hard drive. Anyway, we're doing that. Thank you for interrupting me. So we're reviewing that next week. And watch it. Go out, buy it, listen to our review. Or even just listen to our review and then decide whether or not you want it.
And if people want to go back and listen to some of our classic shows, where can they go?
You deal with this, man. I don't.
Oh, hipster over here won't plug anything.
How's that hipster?
Lawradio.proboards.com is where you go for all of our archives.
Yeah.
Archives.
Yeah. Keep going.
I'm not lying. I slept for 4.5 hours last night, and all I've had are 2 coffees, and I feel like jittery right now.
Really?
Right now. But go to our archives. We have old episodes of
The
Law.
This is the best part of the show when, like, things...
No one's listening at this part. This is literally you and I talking to ourselves.
We've done the review. I think, like, we've been in this room for, like, 2.5 hours just talking. and straight, and we're like in a bit of a weird haze. It's a bit, everything's a bit fuzzy. We're not really talking straight.
There were people last week who we went to the Terry Funk empty arena match and then came back and did the feedback. And then I had some people online ask me, hey, you never said what you're reviewing next week. I'm like, no, you just didn't listen to the whole show.
Yeah. Don't complain if you haven't listened to
every 25 second. Minutes left. This is a lot of Terry Funk at the end. All right. So we're going to chat about the Daniel Bryan documentary next week. Looking forward to catching that. And maybe Daniel Bryan will pop by the show and give him a call.
Really?
See, wow. See if we have time to fit him in next week. I don't know. We run a tight ship. Okay. Go follow Wei at Wei0937. Say what's up to Wei Chung Ting. I am at I am John Pollock. And go to liveaudiowrestling.com. This week, we've got Bauer and Pollock. We've got a new Japanese audio wrestling coming out on Friday as Chris and WH will chat about the best of the Super Juniors finals from this past Sunday and probably a look ahead at the Dominion lineup for Osaka next month. And we're going to have Review and Impact, which is now going to be out Friday night / Saturday mornings. So that will be the new release for Review and Impact. And then Sunday night on the Law, 11 Eastern, we'll have a full rundown of the Money in the Bank show with Dan Lavransky, Jason Agnew, and myself. Are you coming to watch Money in the Bank? Or you at least watch the show?
I might watch it. I don't know if I'll be in Scarborough.
All right.
So
you should make once a month. You go visit your parents, and then you come see your extended family.
Not bad, sure. Maybe I'll invite my parents over.
I would love to.
Maybe you should watch the show at my parents'
place. Do you have access to watch it at your place?
We can. We can. If you'll show up, you and the crew.
If Wing ever wants to come on to the Law and run down a show,
yeah,
he's always invited.
Okay. Thanks. Keep that in mind.
Okay. That's enough. Wei's done. He's giving me the finger, and we are giving you the thumbs up. This show is done, and we'll chat with you next week.
Santino and Maria, sorry to interrupt, but Maria, coming up next, it is Candice Michelle versus Melina in a pudding match.
I know! I love pudding!
That's awesome.
Godzilla! I'm the best of you!